House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. It's Tuesday the 14th. We have a busy agenda, which we're going to take a little bit in a bit different order than is printed. We'll start with House Bill 2180, move on to 2152, just as a preview. So with that, open a work session on House Bill 2180. Barbara, you could give us a quick summary, and I think we'll invite Dave Vantoff, who else was coming with you, Betty Merrill and Deborah Buchanan forward as we hear the summary, please.
HB 2180 establishes the Oregon Renewable Energy Grant Account and allows credit against income taxes for contributions to the account, authorizes the State Department of Energy, DOE, to award grants for renewable energy projects.
And while we while these folks are getting settled, I'm reminded that it might make sense to announce as we get started that 2626 is not ready. It's already scheduled for Thursday, so we'll be taking that up again for any of you who are interested in that today. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Vantoff from the Governor's Office for the record. And thanks again. We've been here before you before to talk a little bit about the governor's proposals in 2180. The dash six is before you. These two are going to walk through, Betty, and the details of the amendments that we're proposing. And just wanted to highlight again a couple of the provisions in here. One is the industrial scale energy efficiency. We're hopeful that that the committee and the legislative body will support expanding the investments and incentives for large-scale industrial energy efficiency. It's a huge place where we can capture greenhouse gas reductions and also create economic benefit for the industrial scale consumers. And the other important piece in here that I wanted to highlight is the proposals around the electric vehicle tax credit program. And with the chair's consent, I was going to invite at the end of the walking through the bill Tim McCabe to come forward and talk a little bit from economic development's perspective about how important that piece is to recruiting the manufacturing sector for EV folks in the state of Oregon.
Please do.
And so I'm going to step back and let Tim come up while they walk through the bill.
The other thing that it might make sense to mention to the committee is that this bill will, its next stop, should it leave this committee successfully, is to go to the Revenue Committee, where three of the members of this committee also sit. So our discussion, hopefully today, is going to be on the policy aspects of it. It will then go to Revenue to talk about the revenue implications. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm going to try and walk you through the Dash 6 amendments. We think we've incorporated and corrected the previous amendments. So in this amendment, we're clarifying that the industrial process energy facilities would be eligible for a 50% tax credit. This corrected an error in the first drafting. We're also defining that an industrial process energy facility would exclude general lighting, heating, cooling, and ventilation. The intent is that the 50% tax credit would only be intended for industrial processes such as motors, compressors, pumps, and other industrial equipment and processes. General lighting, heating, cooling equipment would still be eligible for the 35% conservation credit. We've also clarified the hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and alternative fuel vehicle eligibility, and the proposed amendment would make the plug-in electric vehicle, hybrid vehicles eligible for the business energy tax credit as an alternative fuel vehicle at a 35% of incremental cost. And for the residential energy tax credit, the residential energy tax credit for these vehicles would be up to $5,000. It provides authority to the director in our rulemaking process to set rules and standards for how vehicles would qualify and what their eligible criteria would be. One of those factors would include market acceptance. Another would include technology assessment, type of battery, range. It would also specify factors to consider when determining what the tax credit would be, which would include petroleum use reduction, efficiency, market acceptance, greenhouse gas reductions, and technology. It deletes a phrase in the current legislation which says regardless of energy consumption savings, and adds that the vehicle would produce less exhaust emissions than vehicles fueled by gasoline or diesel. On the biomass biofuel tax credit, I'm going to let Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue walk us through this one.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Our focus has been on sections 4 and 5 of the Dash 6 amendments, where we're looking at clarification of your policy in regards to allowance of the biomass credit and also transfer of the biomass credit. We, in implementing the credit in 2007, ran into some issues, one of which was the statutory language allows the credit for an agricultural producer or biomass collector who transfers the biomass to a biofuel producer. And you'll find that on page 14, lines 14 through 16 of the Dash 6 amendments. The issue was sometimes an agricultural producer or a biomass collector may be the same entity as the biofuel producer. And our attorneys advised us with the language in the statute, there really did need to be a transfer from one entity to another entity. That meant those biofuel producers could not claim the credit even though they were also the agricultural producer or biomass collector because there was no transfer to another entity. So we were looking for some clarity there. And then also in the statute that provides that a credit may be transferred if the entity receiving the credit in the first place is not subject to tax, they have no tax liability for that year, they may be a nonprofit entity that's doing the collecting or the producing of the biomass, they're not able to use the credit, so they want to transfer that or sell it to someone else. And the issue we ran into there was the statute now requires that there be consideration, and this you'll find on page 16, line 24. The credit may be transferred for consideration. Because this credit is not certified by anyone, it may be perhaps less valuable, or there may be some perceived audit risk in someone who chooses to transfer the credit. And what we were finding is that people who had qualified for the credit weren't able to use it, were transferring it without consideration. So they were gifting it to family members, for example, and then a family member would attempt to claim the credit. Because the statute says there needs to be consideration, we disallowed those credits. So we're looking for some policy guidance as to what you want in that area as far as the transfer. The Dash 6 Amendment deletes the language requiring consideration, and instead on page 17 of the Dash 6, you'll see language on starting on line 17, where the Department of Energy establishes a uniform discount rate to be used in calculating the present value of a tax credit, and then the Department of Revenue, by rule, may establish procedures for the transfer. So we're taking that to mean that that amount established by the Department of Energy would be the value of the credit for purposes of transferring that credit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
One question I had just quickly before Director McCabe goes, there were a number of people who talked to me about various issues related to the biomass stuff. Do you believe that this takes care of those issues generally, all of the various provisions that you just described?
Mr. Chairman, the provisions that I have just described, I do believe the Dash 6 take care of that.
I'm not sure
what other issues may have come up.
I think my recollection is that it generally related to the transfer of the credits. So I think that's a good answer.
And if we have, Mr. Chair, if I may, if there are other issues that do arise, perhaps we could look at those in the Revenue Committee, assuming it.
Thank you. Director McCabe.
Yeah. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I think passage of this bill would be a really great idea. I mean, it'll help us attract companies. As many of you know, 2 years ago, we passed the bill on the Betsy for manufacturing of solar, and that enabled us to successfully recruit three very large companies. One, Sanyo, right here in Salem, which has begun groundbreaking here just 2 weeks ago. Solar World in Hillsboro, as you know, Representative Reed, it's been a great boon for that economy. So this bill does that for electric vehicle manufacturing. We're talking to three manufacturing companies right now, Nissan, Think, which many of you may have got to see the cars last week when they were here in town. That truly is an opportunity for manufacturing in Portland to take over the Freightliner facility. And when it's fully built out, they intend to employ 900 people. Okay, we're also in discussions with Mitsubishi. They're going to bring their first electric vehicles in through the Portland area. And what we see, particularly around the manufacturing side with Think, this could be the first time not only will we be importing cars into the Portland market, we could actually start exporting these cars out. So this would be a great opportunity for the state.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the panel? I think maybe we're all digesting the rest of the amendments here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as far as the eligibility for the biomass credit. When the State Department of Energy looks at biomass in consideration of producing electricity with it or something else, is there criteria within the Department of Energy about the emissions that would be part of the criteria?
The agency under rule would go through and establish the criteria. Currently, we've allowed a biomass tax credit for just a second. We don't allow urban waste to receive a credit. Page 13, line 28, I believe, has some criteria for biomass. Does not mean urban waste or wood that has been treated with creosote, pentachlorophenol, inorganic arsenic, or other inorganic chemical compounds. Representative Holby, did I answer your question?
No. It looks also on page 14, line 3, director may adopt rules to define criteria to determine additional characteristics of biomass. So amplifying your answer a bit. Do you have a follow-up then, Representative Holby?
No. I just wanted to see if they had the ability and rule to establish additional criteria, so... Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, I was curious about on page 19 of the dash six amendment, paragraph E up in line 8, the amount of the credit is up to $5,000. And I think we were listening, and I think in transportation, to some of the discussion about the Think vehicle. And I'm just curious what you would be looking at, because I think it's left up to you to determine the amount of the credit. What are you going to be looking at in making the determination of how much that credit should be, and what our state should be worried about when it comes to spending that kind of money on these kinds of businesses? The reason I ask is because I noticed that company was in Chapter 11 reorganization in the country from which it's transferring over to Oregon. Right. Have apparently caught in the downdraft of the drop in fuel prices. And it just seems to me that we, at a policy level, need to be talking about how much money we're going to invest and in what sort of businesses. So this pretty wide open question.
And to clarify, is it you, director of the OECD, or its successor name, or the director of the Department of Energy that would establish that?
Representative Benz, Chair Reed, it would be Michael.
Okay.
grainy from the Department of Energy that would make that determination on how much of the 5,000 would be applied. But if I might,
please,
on the manufacturing, we're well aware of that. On their what's gone on in Norway with their bankruptcy filing and what they're doing over here. So everything that we do for them is contingent upon them being fully capitalized. So it removes any danger from the state on the Betsy's we apply. But this wouldn't pertain to that because this is the consumer, the $5,000 for the consumer, which they have told us, as has Nissan and Mitsubishi, that's extremely important for them to bring their vehicles in here to be successful.
In a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Mr. Director, and thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair, about which director will be making that decision. But am I correct in assuming that you will be working with Director Graney in these kinds of discussions?
Representative Best, Chair Reed, yes, you're correct. We work very closely with the Department of Energy to particularly around the manufacturing credits and that before, you know, it's a group effort, so to speak, you know.
Continuing that question, I'll come back to you in just a second. Could you talk generally about how that might get adjusted over time? One hopes that as the technology advances and market acceptance proceeds, that number could come down.
Chair Reed,
how is that generally done?
Yeah. Thanks. Chair Reed, members of the committee, that's a very good question. The main portion of the car that's the most expensive is the battery. And with battery technology improving every year, you know, they have said to us that they see this as a short-term incentive, that 2 to 3 years down the road, that it'll no longer be necessary.
At all?
At all. That's what we got from Think. We don't hear the same from Nissan. Nissan says 3 to 5 years. But with the technology and the research being done around that battery technology, the price is going to come down dramatically in the next 2 to 3 years.
And we can expect then that the rules would follow that, and that 5,000 would also,
yes,
come down. Thank you. You had a follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $5,000 amount would be in addition to the federal tax credit, which I think is in the neighborhood of $7,500 for certain cars. So it does take us to the same question I asked in transportation, which was the anticipated production. Do you know at 900 employees what sort of production we're looking at? And then I guess the real issue is how many state of Oregon residents would actually take advantage of the thing, because this applies only to folks in the state of Oregon that choose to buy the car. Is that correct?
Representative Bench, Chair Reed, that's absolutely correct. But the research both Nissan and Think have done shows that the Portland market is probably, because of the history there with the Prius and the hybrid cars, the highest per capita in the United States. They feel that market is going to be a prime market. That's the reason all three manufacturers have chosen Portland, and because of the infrastructure being built there between PGE, PacifiCorp, and the city, and the private sector coming together to actually build that infrastructure necessary to support these vehicles. Did that answer your question?
Well, I'm sorry, I included about five questions, and so I'll just go back to
That's
one
okay.
of them. The question was, what sort of production do you anticipate if we have 900 people working there? How many cars are they going at that particular manufacturer? Or maybe to make it broader, there's at least three manufacturers, or maybe 8 or 15 now, with electric cars in Oregon. Do we have any idea what we're talking about when we offer this kind of incentive?
Representative Bentz, Chair Reed, initially they're going to employ 300 people, and which would create 2,000 cars a year, and fully built out in 3 years, I believe. I'll double check this. When they employ 900 people, I think it's goes from up to 2,000 cars annually. Is that?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I believe it's 2,000 cars a year. I have to double check that. I didn't bring those figures with me.
That's fine, Mr. Director. The real point I'm trying to get to is how much money should the state of Oregon be anticipating it should allocate to this particular tax credit?
To the $5,000 tax
Correct.
Credit? I'm going to defer to Betty on that one.
And of course, Representative Benz, we're also going to have the same conversation in the Revenue Department,
yeah,
the Revenue,
yes,
Committee, I'm sure. Not that there's anything wrong with having that discussion frequently, especially in the current environment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz,
In terms of the fiscal around the cost of the $5,000 credit, we're looking at one of the reasons we wanted to have some flexibility within the Department of Energy was to be able to adjust that credit both up and down in terms of what's going to achieve the market penetration that we're looking for. As was mentioned, the time period could be short in terms of how long the credit's extended, and so partly will depend on how soon the vehicles come off the line, how many come out in 2010 versus 2011. But our initial fiscal assessment is that there'd be a very small increase to the program in the next biennium, and that's in part because we'd be phasing out the hybrid credit, which is there's a lot more vehicles are applied for under the hybrid credit than we anticipate will ever be applied for in the next biennium under the expanded EV credit, and then in the second biennium it would ramp up a bit, but again that's largely dependent on how many vehicles reach penetration and what measures DOE takes in terms of scaling back the credit during that period. So we can guess and we can get you some guesstimates, but generally this upcoming biennium, very small fiscal impact. The second biennium starts to ramp up a bit, and that would be adjusted by Department of Energy as need be.
I should have asked earlier, is there a place that you could point to in the amendments where the criteria by which the credit is adjusted is explained? I know we've talked about it generally about market penetration, that sort of stuff, but is it articulated somewhere?
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, it begins on page 19, line 8, and it where it talks about the credit, and then it continues in statute on when you get to page 23.
23, you said?
Page 23, line 7. I'm sorry, line 12, where we start talking about basic eligibility. The total credit, oh, that's fueling station, excuse me.
This covers it. 19, that gives you the
yeah. Under
I'll be determined by director by rule.
Yeah. Under page 19, line 8, under E, for each alternative fuel device that's a plug-in electric hybrid or related equipment, the cost for which credit is allowed under this section shall be determined by the director by rule. The total credit allowed for a plug-in hybrid may not exceed $5,000. I'm looking for the piece that had.
I apologize for pushing on this. I think it's important to talk about the, if there are places to talk about the market penetration, the other things we've already mentioned. You found it, it sounds like?
Yeah, I found, excuse me, Chairman Reed, members of the committee, page 25, line 15, number 4, determine that a vehicle is an alternative vehicle shall be made based on the consideration of petroleum use reduction, efficiency, market acceptance, greenhouse gas emissions reduction, and technology. The intent here is as you're looking at a vehicle and the technology in that vehicle, you're looking at what the fuel economy is, what the range of the vehicle is, and you're looking at the acceptance in the market. So currently with the hybrid vehicle, we don't have the authority to start scaling back the credit as you get larger and larger numbers of vehicles into the market. What this will allow us to do is look at the market, phase out the existing hybrids, bring on the electric cars. Not every plug-in electric would be equal. There would be some at a $5,000 credit, some at a $4,000 credit. The credit would vary depending on the vehicle efficiency and the technology on board.
Are you comfortable with that language? As I read it, determination that a vehicle is an alternative fuel vehicle shall be made, and so on. It doesn't say the level of the amount of tax credit allowed is based on that. Does that connect well enough to accomplish the goal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in addition, on page 26, on line 28, under sub 5, it provides the Department of Energy shall adopt rules governing determination of eligibility verification, maximum eligible costs, and certification, and then goes through the same considerations that that Betty just walked through in terms of fuel efficiency, marketplace acceptance, and what have you.
So you're satisfied that that'll work?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Questions for Representative Holby? We'll come back to Representative Benson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed this, but in the definition of plug-in vehicle, did we ever decide whether that included three-wheel vehicles or not? I didn't see any reference to that definition in the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, it's not specified in the statute, but that would be determined by rule, and Department of Energy has indicated that in their rulemaking that would be a three-wheel vehicle would qualify for the credit. Again, it'd be what would be under consideration is at what scale. Would it be at the high end, at the mid-range, or lower end? And again, the factors that they'd be looking at is the cost of the vehicle, the performance of the vehicle, the charging capability, and those types of things.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the ability to look at what the sliding scale as such for the different types of equipment and efficiencies as far as that consideration goes. But I guess I'm just a little uncomfortable that we don't have a little more definitive definition. I guess that the definition itself is left to rule.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Foley, we certainly could just add an amendment into the bill specification around three-wheel if that was desired, and hopefully that could be done in revenue if we wanted to add that piece.
Thank you. Sister Chairman, you had something to say on that?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one correction. There was a discussion about whether this is allowed to non-residents, and in fact it is allowed to non-residents. You'll see that on page 22, line 1. They are required to prorate it based on the ratio of Oregon income to total income, but the credit is available. Thank you.
Thanks for the clarification. Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. This question may belong in revenue if the bill gets there. And the question is prompted by our experience with modifications to the Betsy credit, where folks who are in midstream are unhappy with the fact that we're making a change. And so my thought is really goes probably to the director about what sort of assertions one can make when you're in the position of trying to attract a business based upon the possibility or not of the continuation of these tax credits. So if the company is going to locate here based upon the prompt that's provided by this $5,000 credit, it seems like it would almost have to contain I hate to say promise, but a hope that the credit would last for a certain period of time. So I'm just curious how that works into a bill like this, because I don't see a sunset in this bill. So we are not really signaling a desire to stop the credit. So what is the thought in regard to the nature of the, I don't want to call it a commitment, but the statement of what we're about. How long is this tax? How long do we say to these folks that we're willing to keep this tax credit in play?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beth and Mr. McCabe can come up and add on to this if I don't get it. But as he indicated, I think what we're hearing from manufacturers interested in locating in Oregon, they've said a window of 3 to 5 years is what they're looking for in terms of getting market penetration before the cost of batteries come down to the point where you're not going to need the incentives and you can ramp down the incentives. So I think we were leaving it to the discretion, obviously, of the revenue committee to decide on what was the appropriate length, but I would say that a four-year period would adequately address the industry's expressed needs and expectations around this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair,
please.
The 4 years would be measured from today or measured from when a company arrives in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, it would be measured from when the expansion goes into effect. So if it was starting in 2010, beginning of 2010, what I'd be suggesting is 4 years from that period. And again, within that four-year period, with the discretion that the Department of Energy has, they could be ramping down that credit as the vehicle reaches certain market penetration levels.
And this is on slightly and thank you for that answer. This is on a slightly different part of the bill, and it has to do with the $5,000 credit for a fueling station. And, of course, a plug-in vehicle, a fueling station, could be fairly modest. Have the rules been developed yet addressing what an electric fueling station is?
Chairman Reed, Representative Benz, under the fueling station requirements of the bill, for Betsy, fueling stations would be eligible potentially for 35% of their cost. Under the RETC, as it currently stands, we have a fueling station and a vehicle. In the hybrid vehicle, we consider them both one, which is why it is a $1,500 tax credit currently.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking at page 23, lines 12 through 17, which talked about a fueling station necessary to operate a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, and the credit could go up to $5,000, and it appeared that the nature of the fueling station was described in subs 3. And I was just envisioning a light socket for $5,000. That's what I was envisioning, which I'm sure would not be the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, this provision would be treated similar to the vehicle itself, which would DOE would have the discretion to establish a scale based on the type of fueling station, how much it costs to put in that fueling station, for instance, how fast it can charge the technology in that fueling station. And so the $5,000 is the highest end that they could go to. They'll have to establish what's the appropriate amount below $5,000 for various types of technology.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Recognizing that this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue, should we choose to do that, I'm interested in what the committee might like to do.
Mr. Chair,
amendments we might
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2180.
Thank you. Representative Holby moves the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2180, dated March 31st, 2009. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2180 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation into the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Very nicely done. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2180 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. It seems you've had some practice with that.
Yeah,
the Revenue Department.
Nothing else I can learn my lines.
Very nice. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2180 moves to Committee on Revenue. Thank you very much. That closed the work session on House Bill 2180. Representative Bailey and Representative Benz will get to continue that conversation in another room. Next on our agenda, open a work session on House Bill 2152. Director McCabe, Paul Grove, don't go too far. Barbara, if you could remind us of the quick summary, please.
HB 2152 changes the name of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission to the Oregon Business Development Commission, changes the name of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to the Oregon Business Development Department, and there are several other changes to the organization, which we've talked about in the past, so we'll carry on.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, we have some amendments, it seems.
Sure. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Barbara's gone through the highlights of the bill. And to recap, we had addressed what the amendments may look like at our last public hearing. And we'll be working through the Dash 1 amendments that came back from Ledge Council. And depending on the committee's preference, we can walk through each and every amendment in the Dash 1, or we can touch upon those of greater significance.
Perhaps we should start with the greater significance ones.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First and foremost, Sections 1 through 7 in the bill dealt with the creation of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. The dash one amendments dealt with change the language to have a treasurer's office representative or designee appointed to the board. That was at the request of a number of folks, and we feel it's a very important change. The dash one also deals with clarifying who the IFA advises and on what programs, as well as highlighting the board's powers to include approval of grants and loans, and this was omitted from the initial draft. It also addresses the administration of the Community Development Block Grant Program. This was omitted from the initial draft as well. And those are some very significant changes with respect to the Infrastructure Finance Authority that we had discussed last time around. Some other changes of note. We reinserted language regarding the role of the ports, the role of capacity building in rural and distressed areas, the role of arts and infrastructure in general with respect to its import in the role of the department and the commission. This was just an initial drafting error, and this was cleaned up in the dash one amendments. We also clarified the Business Development Commission's membership to include a locally elected official and to spotlight that that section. Another item of note in the dash one amendments, there was an initial change regarding the Oregon Business Development Fund, which is an agency business finance program. The initial draft had the department overseeing the approval of loans through that fund, and from the initial commission approval and role, and we wanted to revert back to having the Oversight Commission being the body that would be the one in charge of approving those loans. They have a certain amount of experience and expertise in that, and we want to keep that experience and expertise in place when we administer those funds. Another item of note is a technical change with respect to the Local Economic Opportunity Fund. It had initially discussed just consulting rural representatives, and while important, we wanted to ensure that all geographic and regional representatives were consulted on whatever strategies may come forward so that they align with what the department proposes to do. A final item of note with the dash ones would be with respect to the Office for Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses from DCBS to the department. We had the director prescribing duties and assignments for employees and officers within that. That was something that didn't get discussed much last time during the public hearing, but I think it's important to note that this office is moving from DCBS to our department so that there is a one-stop shop for small business services throughout the state. And that's kind of a highlight of the dash one amendments.
Thank you very much. Shall we start with questions, or do you gentlemen have some comments as well?
Okay.
Any questions? Good to see the gigantic bill again. One of those times when the rookie chair looks up and down, hoping that there's some questions, if there are any. It is a very big bill. Could you talk a little bit about the process you went through from our first hearing, and do you feel like this is ready to go?
Absolutely, Chair Reed, members of the committee. From the initial draft, we didn't have an opportunity to submit amendments, and what we had did was we engaged our stakeholders early on in the process and got their feedback on what the proposed amendments would look like. I think, and then we worked with Legislative Council, and Legislative Council actually did, in my estimation, a very good job in capturing the intent of those amendments and the language therein. And we believe that it's an accurate reflection of what we have proposed to do.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz.
I just wanted to comment again on what an excellent piece of work I think this is. And I did attend, as you know, the meeting out in Baker City. And I'm struck by how far you have come with this device and how much progress I think has been made. And I think the thinking has been excellent. And I think you all deserve a lot of credit for the hard work you've done. I still am reminded, of course, of the question I asked back in Baker City about
how decisions regarding projects and funding will be made. So perhaps you could refresh my memory and tell me how that has evolved. But I know we've broken into different categories now, but maybe you could just share with us if someone has a project having to do with economic development, not infrastructure, and they want the department to look kindly upon it, who ultimately makes that decision about whether it enjoys the support of the department? Perhaps you could just take us through how this new bill would address that kind of a situation.
I'm going to, Representative Benz, Chair Reed, I'm going to have Lynn talk about our business loan programs, and I think that'll give you some idea how those decisions are made. And then we'll talk about business recruitment programs, if you're interested in that, and how we pick those companies and choose the ones that we were trying to attract. So with that, I'll give it to Lynn on our business loan programs.
Sorry, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Chesler. I'm the Deputy Director with the Department. to answer Representative Benz's question, frankly, there's a parallel that runs between both our infrastructure side of our department as well as our business side of the department, and that is that we have regional representatives around the state that do work with local businesses or, in the case of infrastructure, communities. So somebody's interest in a business loan gets brought to the department. It gets vetted through the channels of the staff in the field, then to the staff in the department, the specialists in those particular fields, and they proceed through a staff underwriting process that then gets referred to the department's loan committee. The loan committee is appointed by our commission, and the loan committee is largely representatives of banking institutions around the state that then look at that, and those loans get their endorsement before they're approved by the department.
And thank you. And then attracting the new business, perhaps you could address that.
I'm sorry. Representative Bent, Chair Reed. On the business recruitment side of things and business growth, we've had our commission give us direction on that, and we're primarily concentrating on five industries right now. This isn't to the exclusion of all others, but this is to the ones that we know show the best future for this state. Those are the green technologies like solar, wind, wave technologies, and green building, which Oregon enjoys a very significant advantage, particularly around green building. We have more LEEDs qualified buildings in this state than any place else. Our second area of focus is natural resources. That's ag and wood products. Nursery products are a huge industry in Oregon, and we work with the Department of Agriculture around that to grow those markets both here and in exporting. High technology, again, is one that we're focusing on. That's not limited to the Intels of the world. There's hundreds, I dare to say, over 1,000 high-tech companies now as a result of Tektronix and Intel being in Oregon. So we always recruit around our existing businesses' needs. So we're recruiting companies that are suppliers to our high-tech industry. It's not the Intels of the world. It's these 20 and 30 people, employers, that really make up the high-tech industry in Oregon. Our fourth one is manufacturing. We work on lean manufacturing technologies with existing Oregon businesses. Members of our Ways and Means Committee, of which Representative Witt is one, got to see some of the results of what we've done, particularly around lean technology and how it benefits manufacturing here in the state. And then our fifth industry that we're targeting on is sports apparel and sportswear, which, again, Oregon enjoys a very large industry that's nationwide. It's worldwide. We've got Adidas, Nike, Columbia Sportswear. We're known as the sports apparel capital of the U.S.
Thank you.
Representative Gillian.
Mr. Chair.
The promotion.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that the director did not say that in the correct order. He didn't say that out of any...
That's fine. Thank you.
That's correct.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Thatcher.
Just to clarify the basic, if you just have to distill this bill down to one line, would it be just a change in how, a streamlining of how funds are accessed? Would that be fair to say? When it has, dealing with that little section of the bill, not the changing of the name and all that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, if I had to put it in a 30-second soundbite or less, I would say that it clarifies the role of the department to focus on the business efforts of the state, but additionally creates a separate and more streamlined, to use your words, means to provide infrastructure financing to the communities, ports, special districts throughout the state.
Thank you.
It's also worth noting, before we take any motions, that this bill next goes to Ways and Means. We have at the end of our packet a fairly detailed analysis from legislative fiscal. So we're talking about the general policy, of course, and then the fiscal impact would be taken up by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. With that, if there aren't any other questions, we have some amendments before us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move the, if I can find them here. Move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3909.
Thank you. Representative Vence moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2152 dated March 9th, 2009. Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the dash one amendments? Seeing none, dash one amendments are adopted. Representative Vence.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2152 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill referred to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Vence moves House Bill 2152 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none. Representative Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to repeat that I'm very grateful for the work you've done on this. This is not exactly the climate of great hope and positive attitudes, but I think you understand that. I don't think you're just rearranging deck chairs, and I just have a lot of hope in what you can do, particularly when we talk about small business. I want to go on record as saying I know you have a commitment to small business. And I like the one-stop shop idea, and I just want to, add my encouragement that that's where jobs are. And anything you can do and are doing through reorganization and breathing life into strategic programs for small business in my district and in the state is, you have my full support.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Your comment reminds me of an article I read yesterday in The New Yorker from James Surowiecki, who writes a financial column each week and went through the history, the economic history of the United States, noting that inordinate success enjoyed by companies who stick to research, development, advertisement, and so on in times of other economic trouble. So I think that amplifies your point and appreciate your work. If there aren't any other comments, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also like the bill. Although I have always remained a little bit troubled by the name change, frankly, I kind of wonder why the Oregon Infrastructure Finance Authority is now under the Oregon Business Development Department as such, just because of the name change. But actually, infrastructure is also for our community and, you know, broader economic development, not just business development. So. But other than that, I love the bill.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion, which was to send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation and refer it to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. House Bill 2152 goes on to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Thank you very much. With that, close the work session on House Bill 2152. And we'll next take up House Bill 2531, so open up a work session and invite Mr. Peden forward. Barbara, if you could give us a summary, please.
HB 2531 expands the purpose of the Major League Stadium Grant Fund to include the financing, developing, construction, and furnishing of a Major League Stadium designed to use by a Major League Soccer team.
Thank you. I think we also have some amendments for this in our packet. Mr. Peden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Greg Peden here representing the Paulson family and Portland Timbers. What you have before you, I believe, is the Dash 2 amendments. I just want to walk you through what they do on the original bill. Very simple amendments, really. They separate out the language relating to Major League Soccer from the existing statutory language regarding Major League Baseball. There was some conflicting and some confusing overlap in terms of what dollar amounts and what funds would be attributable to Major League Soccer versus Major League Baseball. So to simplify that, we rewrote the bill here in these amendments to reflect as a standalone statutory language for soccer. We also added in a sunset clause for soccer that you see at the very end of the amendments. Unlike the Major League Baseball piece, where we want to leave that open for the potential to receive a hopefully receive a Major League Baseball team someday, the soccer team has been awarded to the Paulson family, and we're in the process of putting the financial package together between my client, the City of Portland, and hopefully the state. And so sunset clause would be appropriate to close this out once we've got a team on board and got a bonding capacity issued and a deal done. I think that's it.
Thank you. I imagine there are some questions. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the good news is, since you were here, it was awarded.
Correct.
How does that change? Maybe you're saying it doesn't. How does that change the dynamic of what we're looking at today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, it does not, because of the timing to get the franchise from the within the deadline for Major League Soccer and the sequence of being able to move a bill here. That's just sort of ended up that way, but it doesn't change the dynamics here whatsoever. We still need some help from the state here to make this happen. And I should say that the final sale of the franchise to my client is contingent on having a stadium package in place by September 1.
I'm looking up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I apologize for not being familiar with the amendments. Can you just assure me or review for me the relationship the amendments have to the baseball question, the Coliseum versus Lentz? Is that, did you already say that? And I apologize if I didn't hear you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, no, I did not say that. There are two pieces to the financing package that we are working on with the City of Portland. One is to retrofit PG Park for a Major League Soccer stadium. Two is to build a new minor league baseball stadium at in the Rose Quarter. Presumably at the Memorial Coliseum site, but that's not completed just yet. The financing of the Rose Quarter section is the transaction between the City of Portland and the Paulson family. It is not what we are asking for, assistance for the state here. The piece that we're asking here for is for Major League Soccer to finish out the reconstruction of redevelopment of PG Park.
Further questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess on the amendments, the dash two amendments are what we're speaking to. On section one, when you're including the revenues that are generated from the tax liabilities of members of the professional soccer team, can you explain to me the rationale for also including the spouses of those members when they, in fact, may not be working for the professional soccer team? They may be working somewhere else in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure why that's in there, to tell you the truth. That is all I can tell you, that is language borrowed from the existing baseball statute, but the idea here would be to use the incremental tax revenue off the team, the player salaries. That's, I don't have an answer for that, and I don't think that's the salary taxation off of those salaries would not be calculated or not have been in my calculations on what this would generate. So that's something we could remove, and I don't think we'd have any heartburn over that.
question.
I'd be favorable to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the incremental soccer tax revenues in the year substantially exceed the amount reasonably required to amortize a loan of $15 million over a period of 30 years? Do you have a number? Have you run that number of what we're looking at each year?
What I have, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, is the incremental tax collection from the team in terms of a gross number, in terms of what the starting payroll would be for the team in year one, and an estimated collection of the payroll tax, of the income taxes for 30 years.
And Mr. Pudin, you had said earlier, if I'm remembering correctly, that the salaries for these athletes are dictated by the league. Is that?
That is correct. That's why I'm able to calculate that those numbers out. What I don't have, Representative Benz, just yet is an estimate from the state exactly on what their analysis of those numbers are. Given those numbers to legislative revenue, but I'm assuming that we'll hear from them if and when we come to revenue committee next, and they'll have put a quantifiable number on those. I've given them the gross numbers, but there are some calculations they'll need to do to sort of narrow that down.
Does this have a subsequent referral to revenue?
It does. Thank you.
Well, then I won't ask more questions about revenue.
Okay. Very good. Other questions?
One more, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gillian.
I just wanted to mention, it doesn't have to be addressed in the bill, but as much as I just want to make sure we got on record here, I want to be sure that if we do move ahead with a Memorial Coliseum site, that you're, and I think I know what you're going to say, that you're sensitive to the memorial aspect of that site. Is that something you guys are dialed into?
Representative Gillen, we absolutely are. We have been in conversations with not only the State Department of Veterans Affairs, but a number of coalition of veterans associations in the Portland area that are primarily the keepers of that memorial. And whether it is a new stadium that's the decommissioning of the current Memorial Coliseum and a new memorial stadium or something like that, or it's some other recognition of them, we fully intend to work cooperatively and design whatever memorial that they're satisfied with.
Thank you.
It may be that I've missed it, but I think I'm noticing some new language in Section 4 talking about an advisory committee. Could you talk a bit about that, what that might do? I'm looking at page 7, line 11 through 15.
Okay.
I don't recall seeing that in the original version of the bill, but maybe I've missed it.
Chairman Reed, that was in the original bill.
Okay.
Yeah, that was language from the original baseball bill. That is what that language is intended, is to just provide some oversight in the structure that's articulated there to the grant fund, so that there's some legislative oversight over how the grant fund's managed. But that was in the original bill.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you've answered this before, but can you share with us again the return the state of Oregon and I guess the city of Portland anticipate receiving from the addition of this soccer team to the local economy, and what it is we're getting back in return for this type of investment?
Absolutely, Representative Benz. On a number of different levels, we estimate 600 construction jobs out of this effort, 300 new permanent jobs.
You get a little closer to your mic.
I'm sorry. 600 construction, short-term construction jobs out of this venture, 300 permanent new jobs, and then an annual economic impact of about $30 million a year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Given that, it seems like we have uncovered a potential deletion that might need to be made to these amendments. Representative Colby, it sounds like you would be favorable to making that change.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't. Does this have a subsequent to another committee?
Revenue.
I certainly question why we would include the spouses of members of the professional soccer team in including them in the incremental soccer tax revenues. Because they're not they could be working somewhere else in the community, and I'm just and I realize they may be in a joint return, and maybe it's easier that way. I don't know, but it just doesn't seem like it's consistent to me, because they may or may not. I mean, if they're working for the soccer team or in Major League Soccer, then that they wouldn't need that definition. If they're outside of that, it just doesn't seem like it's appropriate to me.
Okay, I appreciate that comment, Representative Holby. It seems that our choice then, we can't move the bill today in any case, because we don't have the fiscal and revenue statements, so we'll be waiting till Thursday. It seems like we have a couple of choices. We can adopt the Dash 2 amendments, look for that sort of a change, or at least the discussion of that in the Committee on Revenue, or we can wait and try to get a Dash 3 that would make that correction. Sounds
like your preference, Mr. Chair. I'm fine either way.
Okay. Mr. Peden, would you want to weigh in on that question? It seems like we might be do just as well to wait, since we can't move it anyway. Try to get that that oversight corrected and move it all in one shot.
That makes sense to me.
Okay, very good. Given that, if there are any other questions or points on House Bill 2531, we'll close the work session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is that already on for 2531?
Carry it over.
Very good. So we can. It appears I may have done that a little prematurely. So reopen the work session on House Bill 2531 merely to announce that we'll carry that over to Thursday and continue the discussion then. Session on House Bill 2531. Open work session on House Bill 2408. As you'll remember, this bill about light rail. And hopefully we have a quick summary. I know Kelly Taylor is here. Aaron Dees may or may not be here. And Tom Powers, I think, may be on his way. There he is. He's looking for you.
HB 2408 creates the task force on extending Washington County commuter rail to Salem, delineates the representation on the task force, and outlines a potential evaluation process to determine the viability of extending the current West Side service west to Salem-Keizer.
Mr. Powers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Tom Powers, for the record. I'm here on behalf of Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, who is currently in a committee and in about five other meetings that are concurrently happening. So I appreciate you entertaining legislative staff coming before your committee to talk to you about the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2408, which relates to the extension of the Westside Express service from its Beaverton to Wilsonville line, which is currently in operation, down to Salem. The bill as written would convene a task force that consists of about 20 or so entities that are mostly local governments and agencies, as well as owners of rights-of-way and rail line. The Dash 2 amendments, which you have before you, incorporate some of the changes that you saw in the Dash 1 amendments, which included changing the name of the original Washington County Commuter Rail to West and changing up what the report that the task force would produce would actually do. So the Dash 2 amendments, in consideration of the use of legislative administration committee services resources, was the task force has been taken out of the legislative administration committee and put into the realm of back into legislative administration committee services, but not creating a new task force to do this. It would be up to the members and chairman of a committee as named in the amendments in page 2 on Section 2, a committee related to sustainability and economic development. I presume that would be this committee, unless it is changed in the interim. The entities that were named at the task force remain named in the Dash 2 amendments, and there are a couple additions, including the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, because Chair Peterson testified at the last hearing on this bill. And so how this would work functionally is the director of ODOT Rail would send a report, which is currently being done for the record, on commuter rail, including the extension from Wilsonville to Salem, to the entities listed in here, which are effectively the entities who would participate in the task force. Those entities would then have the option to send a statement back to this committee, and it would be up to the chairman and its and the members of this committee to take further action on that in the interim, if you are so interested.
Thank you. Before we take any questions, I did want to note that we received some written testimony from Senator Bonamici, which I think you all have, so we'll note that for the record. She's supportive of the bill. Are there any questions for Mr. Powers? A quiet committee today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And have we seen Ms. Taylor? She's returned. It's hard to see the back row. We have not seen her. So the Dash 2 amendments are before us. we have a revenue and fiscal statement. So this bill is ready to go if we choose to adopt the amendments. Committee, what's, in the words of our revenue chair, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I'll move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2408.
Thank you. Representative Holby moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2408, dated March 30, 2009. Any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I got to admit I'm a little disappointed. The 4th Congressional District isn't included in this bill. I thought it would have been quite an advantage to include them. But notwithstanding that, I'm not really familiar with Donald. I am familiar with the rest of the cities on the agenda, but I still think it looks like a fine bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've noticed that Ms. Taylor has joined us now. Perhaps we can take this motion and then hear from her. If there any other discussion on the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing no objection, Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Before we take another motion, Ms. Taylor, would you like to say anything about the bill as now amended by the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Petty, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Rail Division. I'm familiar with the amendments. I've talked with Tom Powers of Representative Greenlink's office, and it is the study that I reported to you earlier that I am doing in the middle of. We just started, and we'll be publishing it later this fall, and I will make it available to lots of people, including the people on this list.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Taylor? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to understand what we're doing here.
You're going to say something about Donald, by the way?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am.
Thank you.
Sorry, you have to hear this. It comes to no surprise at all to me that the representative from the Emerald Empire knows nothing about my district. He's never cared about my district.
It's unfortunate, given that Donald has an association that he might also have some familiarity with.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, sorry we digress. But and I am excited because, to my complete surprise, I'm certainly sure not in my lifetime, but to my surprise, there is some relationship of light rail, even if in a task force, to my district. We are going to use this committee as the reporting structure or as the task force. Is that what these amendments are about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gillum, that is correct. I will be reporting back to this committee on the study and what we find. I'm sure I'll probably be reporting to the House Transportation Committee as well.
Follow up,
please.
And again, you're already in the middle of the study, which has been adequately funded or there's been provisions made for. We're not asking for any more money. We're asking for the conclusion of something already underway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillum, that's correct.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, we also have just to follow up on that, Representative Gillum, we had the fiscal and revenue statements at the back, which confirm that. So the good news for you, if they make the report back to this committee, is you can continue making light rail a priority for your district and for the city of Donald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. With that, if there are any other questions from Sailor or comments on the bill as now amended, if not, Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 2408 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Bence moves House Bill 2408 as amended to the floor with the due passage recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Motion passes. House Bill 2408 goes to the floor with the due passage recommendation. It seems appropriate that we ask Representative Greenlick to carry. Mr. Powers, a nod or a shake of the head if that's been getting thumbs up. So Representative Greenlick will carry. That closes the work session on House Bill 2408 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3056. Remember, if you could give us a summary, please.
HB 3056, amend statute relating to urban renewal plans and their maximum amount of indebtedness that may be issued or incurred under the plan, requires 50% of increment to be added to the total assessed value of property within an urban renewal area whenever increment equals total assessed value.
Thank you. This, as we get started, is an opportunity to hear the results of an ongoing group who has discussed the issues around urban renewal. I think we're going to be pleased with what they have to report. But just as an opening comment, this bill awaits amendments, which we do not yet have. So we're here today to hear the story of the work that has gone on. There are four people who have signed up to testify, so I'm just going to read the names. Most of these folks, I think, have coordinated their testimony, so I'll let you guys decide how you want to handle it, if all four people want to come up together, or what were four people I have are Alec Jensen, Doug Rue, Larry Harvey, and Bob Broman.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm Alec Jensen from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and with me this afternoon is Doug Rex, who is the current president of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies.
I apologize for the mispronunciation. Thank you.
We're here this afternoon to tell the story, success story, about and then representative of so many people in this room. I believe you have some written testimony from us that has a exhaustive list of urban renewal stakeholders that we are essentially speaking in behalf of. That is noteworthy for those of you who have been party to discussions about urban renewal legislation over the last three or four sessions, because we're here this afternoon in agreement with regard to the amendment that we're here to talk about. Also, in addition to that list, we've had a number of attorneys participating. We've even had the Bank of America at the table, which we understand is the largest purchaser of urban renewal bonds in Oregon. So all these people have been helpful and contributed to a long and exhaustive conversation that started back in October, and we've been meeting almost weekly since the snowstorm. Thank you for mentioning that we are not here essentially this afternoon to talk about House Bill 3056. This is going to be a gut and stuff. We're here to talk about the framework for an amendment. We received word late yesterday afternoon from Legislative Council that while they could have the amendment ready today, simply put, it wouldn't be their best work. And we chose to wait for their best work, if you will. It's my job this afternoon to talk about the framework of the amendment, and then Doug is going to share with you subject that you might even be more enthused about than the actual amendment, which is our agreement as a group as we roll forward in subsequent sessions. The amendment has essentially three component parts, and unless you choose, I'm not going to get into the math of it. If you do choose, I want to make sure that you understand we have a number of experts in the audience that may have a better capacity to answer some of the technical aspects than either Doug or I do, and so we may defer to them. But with that said, there's three essential elements to this urban renewal amendment, the first of which is to establish a relationship between what we refer to as frozen base and maximum indebtedness. And one of the issues that many overlapping taxing districts have had has been the size of maximum indebtedness, which is essentially as a proxy in some part for how long it takes to complete the urban renewal plan. And so we have a framework here identifying small, medium, and large urban renewal plans by their essentially frozen base and limits on essentially how much in debt, how much debt they can incur. As an example, a small plan is a plan with a frozen base of anything less than $50 million, and they can have a maximum indebtedness of up to $50 million. So, hypothetically, you could have an urban renewal area that has little or no value whatsoever and still be able to bond as much as $50 million to accomplish the tasks of the urban renewal plan. Then there's a middle plan, which has a frozen base of between $50 million and $150 million. For that size plan, you would be able to have the maximum indebtedness of the first 50, and then 50% of the increment above that. So in other words, if you had $100 million assessed value, you'd have your first 50, the next 50% would be $25 million, so you'd have a maximum indebtedness of 75. And then for the very large plans, those plans that exceed $150 million of frozen base, there's another calculation that drops it down to 35%. The next element of the amendment deals with the return of value. One of the issues we were trying to speak to here is not always does an urban renewal plan create a substantive increase in demand for service on the part of the overlapping taxing districts. Purely from a fire district standpoint, sometimes it just means the bell goes off a little more often and you have existing infrastructure, firefighters in place that can respond, and there's really no increase in demand. There are other types of urban renewal plans, however, that could have could cause a substantive increase, and so the overlapping taxing districts felt that the ability to get some return on revenue, some return on investment prior to the completion of the plan would be helpful to provide those services if you had to build a fire station, if you had to build a school, and so forth. And so in the amendment, there's a mechanism to accomplish that. And then the third part of the amendment deals with the plan amendment part. Today, albeit we have a consult and confer process, urban renewal agencies can, through a substantive substantial amendment process, increase the size of the maximum indebtedness, sometimes quite substantially. And the effect of that oftentimes is extending the life of the urban renewal plan. The amendment contains a provision whereby, still under the consult and confer process, an urban renewal agency may increase its maximum indebtedness up to 20%. They could choose to do this in a single action of 20% or in several amendments with an aggregate not to exceed 20%. Or, with concurrence of the overlapping taxing districts, they can have as many amendments as they want to increase the maximum indebtedness as much as they want. So it's very exciting that we've gone from, in this context, a consult and confer basis to a concurrence basis. So that in a nutshell, are the three real substantive elements from our perspective on what we'll have in the amendment, which we expect to have out of Legislative Council at any time. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I defer to Doug, and Doug can fill in the blanks.
Maybe we should start with filling in whatever blanks you left, but it doesn't sound like many, and then we can take some questions. Thanks.
Be happy to.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Rux, president of the Association of Oregon Renewal Agencies. Mr. Jensen walked you through the first three aspects of this. The fourth piece, we think, is relatively large, is a memorandum of understanding that has been developed between the parties who've been in these negotiations since December. Part of this MOU indicates that there is an intent that urban renewal is still a viable tool in the state, but there's also the need for releasing tax values back to the overlapping taxing districts. So through a tool that we've created that the parties are in the process of signing now is to have this MOU in effect between today and effectively January 1st of 2017. There are 6 points that we've effectively integrated into this MOU. Briefly, they just allude to and reference the fact that we are opposing other urban renewal legislation in this session because we believe the bill that's been prepared and will be back before you addresses many of the issues. the parties want to continue to work in good faith. I think that's one of the things that we'll get to in a few comments, is about a cooperative group that would be in place to continue to talk and have dialogue about urban renewal and the overlapping taxing districts in the future. The parties have agreed to oppose legislation in the future, not by the parties themselves, because we would work through a cooperative group, but other legislation that may come forward in future sessions. But then we also allowed some caveats. We know that sometimes legislation does come forward by means other than from our group that we've been working with. And there also may be some situations where we have legislation that needs to come forward as this cooperative group has identified. Some tweaks or fixes may be necessary in the future based upon the cooperative bill that we're working on this year. Finally, there's this oversight group, and that would be members of the groups that have negotiated, as well as members from AORA, to sit down, and we would start this group in January of 2010. We would meet on a time frame to be determined and established, but we would sit down and have dialogue and discussions about urban renewal as it occurs statewide. We've made some agreements to continue to educate our various members, both on the AORA side and as well as the overlapping taxing districts. We've talked about going to the different conferences that the different groups and so forth have to talk about urban renewal, how it works, and how this cooperative bill would work into the future. With that, I think I'll stop, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
Representative Holby.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the work everybody's been doing on this bill. One simple question. I'm just assuming in the reference to the 75% of the overlapping district is used a couple times for making decisions, and I'm assuming that this, it's actually the way it's worded, it's 75% of the taxing district's participants, not really based on their, tax value that they represent.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, it's based upon the percentage of the revenue that they've foregone. So it's not based on a number per se. Let's say you had nine overlapping taxing districts, each one would have a vote. It's based on the percentage that they've foregone. And if we want to get into some more of the details with that, we have Harvey Rogers here, and he can respond to that in a little more detail.
Is it reasonable then to characterize it, just to take rough numbers, that if there was 100, you'd need 75 of the
100.
Millions that would have to agree?
Yes. Right.
Is that responsive, Representative Holby? Would you like to hear from Mr.
Well, that's exactly what I was questioning, whether it was based on that foregone value or whether it's actually based on the number of taxing districts. And so you're saying it's based on the foregone value.
Okay. Good. Other questions?
More of a comment.
Go ahead.
It almost reminds me of the MLAC board. They have to come forward and, you know, approve of any proposed legislation. So it's kind of interesting.
Good model. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just commend the process here that I think has been pretty remarkable in coming to a lot of these agreements. I know this is an extremely contentious issue that has come up in a number of previous sessions, although I haven't been here to witness that, and the sides that have come to the table to work at a really technical level, I think, has been very impressive.
Well said, Representative Bailey.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It appears we have two more people signed up. That's you, Mr. Harvey, too, I think. You passing?
Chair, I won't take the committee's time right now. I'm going to hold the
mark. Okay. Mr. Harvey does not want to be heard, so it's up to you, Mr. Vroman.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, I'm Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Assessors Association. And I just wanted to say to the committee that obviously whenever there's legislation that will affect the calculation we use in order to produce a timely and accurate tax roll, we're very interested, and urban renewal certainly does set up a situation where it has a major effect on our process. We also recognize that the groups involved in this. The agencies and the overlapping districts have a stake in achieving a result that's going to allow them to enjoy the benefits that they both would, in fact, receive from this legislation. And we appreciate being at the table to work with them through this process in order to achieve that, as well as a process that the assessors can effectively, efficiently, and readily administer.
We appreciate you being part of that discussion, too.
Thank you.
It has to work.
It has to work.
Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. That was my point exactly. Developing the proposal has been key and monumental, as you suggested, and developing the implementation is just as important. And so we raised an issue with the component in the bill, or in the proposed amendments, that would certify to the assessor an amount to raise as opposed to the amount of value to use to calculate the taxes. And so that's kind of the most important aspect for us. And all I can say is that would be, for us, to just give you a sense of the concern, it would be like telling us, the Department of Revenue, to raise $11.2 billion in the next biennium and back into the tax rates. And so that's kind of just an idea of our concern. And the group, the coalition, has been more than willing since we began our discussions to work with us on that, and I'm very optimistic. Thank you.
And so is it your understanding that concern has been reflected in the amendments that are forthcoming?
Mr. Chair, we've had several discussions, and that my understanding is that they are the proposal is being drafted to address those concerns.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel? Never had a committee this quiet this afternoon. You guys have stumped everyone. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3056, recognizing that we're waiting for some forthcoming amendments? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll just reiterate that we're waiting for the amendments. We've heard good discussions of them, and we'll look forward to seeing this bill again when those amendments are ready to go. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3056. It appears that we've exhausted our agenda a bit early. If there aren't any other comments from the committee.
Are we posted for 2626, Mr. Chair, for Thursday already?
Thank you for asking. Yes, House Bill 2626 is on the agenda for Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No one's listening to us anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Do you have any objection to this?
I did say that.
Okay, I just
looks like.